So Luke chapter 7 today, after hearing Christ's sermon in Luke chapter 6, we will now see his compassion in Luke chapter 7. They say that people don't care what you know until they know that you care. Well, if that be so, in Jesus you have no excuse, because he is knowledge and compassion personified. He is not only the master teacher that we learn from in Luke chapter 6, he is also the great physician in Luke chapter 7 that we will see filled with compassion for people in situations of need. Not all physicians have compassion. They call that poor bedside manner. A couple years ago, there was a man in a hospital room. He was waiting to hear a word about his father's health. And the doctor walked in and said, "Mr. Erickson, I have some great news for you, if you're not a huge fan of your dad." Well, that's not very good bedside manner. I think that lacks a whole lot of compassion, but that's not how you'll find Jesus. How's the bedside manner for this great physician? Well, in the first 10 verses of Luke chapter 7, which is what we're going to cover today, those first 10 verses, he will show up bedside at a young man that is sick in bed, and he will have compassion on that young man and raise him up from what would be a terminal illness, the scripture will tell us. Then in verses 11 through 17, which we will not cover today, we'll hold that off for next week, he will show up bedside again, except this time it's a deathbed, not someone on their deathbed, someone in their deathbed, a man in a coffin, and the scriptures will say that he will have compassion on that man. He's not even asked to raise that man from the dead. They've given up. But he'll see the weeping and the mourning, he'll see the physical need, and he will have compassion on them as well. And he will raise that young man up from the coffin, raising him from the dead. That is the best kind of bedside manner. A physician who deeply and genuinely cares for our needs, and one that will never have to worry about hearing say, "I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. It's gone too far. The situation is out of control." We would have expected Jesus to say that about the dead guy. I mean, can you imagine your loved one dying and hearing the doctor say, "Well, bring him back in 2 days and we'll run some tests and see if there's anything we can do for him"? You wouldn't expect that from your doctor. You would expect Jesus to not have that same kind of hope and compassion in a situation like that, but he does, because he's our great physician and nothing is too big for him. A man on a sick bed, a man in a coffin, nothing is too big for him. Even death can't stop him when he determines to heal or to raise. So let's begin our look into this study into the compassion of Jesus. Verse 1. "Now when he concluded all his sayings in the hearing of the people," that's talking about Luke chapter 6, "he has finished up the Sermon on the Plains. And after he had finished that teaching, he entered Capernaum." Verse 2, "And a certain centurion's servant who was dear to him was sick and ready to die." A centurion was a Roman officer that commanded a century of soldiers. How many is in a century? 100. So he was a commander over 100 soldiers. His name is not given to us in the scriptures, and he is only one of 4 centurions in the scriptures that are singled out to teach us stuff by the Lord. And all 4 of those centurions that are singled out in the scriptures are shown to be respectable men of great character. You have this Luke chapter 7 centurion who is highly respected and commended to Jesus. You have the centurion on the hill of Calvary as Jesus is dying, and he's watching Jesus die, and at the end he concludes, "Truly this was the Son of God." You can see that in Matthew chapter 27 and Mark chapter 15. You have the centurion named Cornelius, the first Gentile to be converted and baptized in the Spirit in Acts chapter 10. And then later on in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 27, you'll see Julius the centurion who befriends the Apostle Paul and assists him in his journey toward Rome. So in each case, when we see centurions in the Scriptures, they are shown in a very favorable light, men of very good character. The centurion in Luke chapter 7 was quite attached to this particular servant. And that servant had caught a case of something pretty major. And as we read, he is on his deathbed. He is heading for death. This is chronic. This is terminal. Luke says he was at the point of death. And in Matthew's record of this, Matthew chapter 8 verse 6, Matthew says that this servant was paralyzed from this sickness and was dreadfully tormented. So that rules out the man flu. This had to be worse than the man flu. The reason I say that is because when a man has the man flu, it does paralyze him. But it's the wife that is dreadfully tormented. So we're definitely talking about a different sickness here. Whatever this is, it was bad and would have killed him without divine intervention. So verse 3, when he, the centurion, heard about Jesus, he sent elders of the Jews to him, pleading with him to come and heal his servant. Now, let me put this in perspective to you for just a moment here. This is like a non-churchgoer that is in great need coming up to you and asking you to take their prayer need before the church. That's kind of what this is like. And how would you respond to that? Would you be one of those people that snap back and say, well, if you're interested in the Lord's help, you know where the church is located. Get yourself to church. If you want the church to pray, you go talk to the church people. See, these men could have done that. These Jewish men, they could have done that. They could have said, hey, you know exactly where Jesus is right now. You know exactly what he's doing. You know he's out there ministering. So go ask him yourself. Go mix into the crowd. Go follow Jesus for yourself. But they don't do that. And here's the amazing thing about this to me. This centurion man is such a respectable man that these Jewish elders are going to take this concern to Jesus and they're going to go to bat for him. I cannot stress to you how surprising this is to see in the Scriptures. You have to remember what a centurion is. This is an enforcer of the Roman rule that is over the nation of Israel. This is a guy that is in league with the people that are oppressing the Jews. And so as we've very well covered in our early portion of Luke here, the Jews naturally would not have a very strong affinity toward the Romans in any way, shape, or form, especially one of the soldiers, especially one of the officers. You wouldn't expect for these folks to be friends in going to bat for this man. But they couldn't help but like this man. And he must have been a truly great man to deserve that honor. One of the oppressing officers, but they respect him so much and they like him so much that they take this message to Jesus to get him help. Verse 4, and when they came to Jesus, they begged him earnestly, saying that the one for whom he should do this was deserving. Verse 5, for he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. So these were more than merely paid messengers. They are imploring Jesus. They are begging Jesus earnestly. Yeah, we know he's a Gentile. We know he's a Roman. But he's such a good guy. He cares about his servant a lot. And he deserves, see that word deserving? He deserves to have his servant healed by you. He's built us a synagogue so that we can go and study the Old Testament scriptures. He loves our Jewish nation. He supports us. He cares about us. He's a good friend, a good man. Will you help him out? Now, this message that they bring in verse 4 is not a message that they were sent with. This centurion did not say, hey guys, can you go talk to Jesus and really talk me up? Really convince Jesus that I'm worthy of this, that he would do this for me. And I want to remind you that the Bible records things as is. And not everything that you read in the Scriptures is worth imitating. You have to balance the entire Word of God to know what is good to imitate and what is not good to imitate. For example, this is certainly not the correct approach to take with the Lord. If you want the Lord to meet the need of a friend, this is not the way. Lord, you really should do this for this person because they are such a good person. Their church attendance is impeccable. Lord, you owe this person that blessing that they're praying for. If you are praying for your own need, for the Lord to meet your own need, I assure you this is not the way to pray. Lord, I haven't cursed hardly at all this week. Lord, I deserve to have this prayer answered. I've been a pretty good person, Lord, for the last couple days. And so I am here to cash in on my good behavior points. I'm ready for you, Lord, to pay me back for how well I've done for you this week or this month or this year or this decade if you're really on a hot streak. But I doubt it. That's not the way that we do it. We appreciate their efforts. We know what they're saying here. They're so impressed with this guy. But Jesus is not going to meet the need of this man and his servant just because of what the Jews had to say about him. In John chapter 2, verse 25, for example, the scriptures tells us that Jesus had no need that anyone should testify of man, for he knew what was in man. In other words, if you want something from the Lord, please don't bring the Lord your references. Please don't try to convince the Lord how deserving or how worthy you are to receive from him. He doesn't need your personal references. He knows you. He knows you. For the good or for the bad, he knows you. No, the Lord is going to do this because of the centurion himself. Because of the centurion himself. As we'll see, this centurion has great faith, and quite contrary to the glowing report of self-merit that the Jews brought about this man, quite contrary to that, this centurion is a very humble man. A very humble man that does not see himself as worthy or deserving of the blessings of the Lord. And that is always going to go farther with the Lord than self-pride. Humility. Humility. Humility always goes farther with the Lord than tooting your own horn. Don't sound the trumpets. Lord, I'm praying. Check this out. Listen to what I say. I've been practicing this in my head, Lord. Lord, I'm getting ready to give. Sound the trumpet. Watch what I give, Lord. 20 this week. Amazing. No, humility goes much farther with the Lord because you can study the scriptures for yourself and you'll realize that anything that God gives to people, he gives as gifts. He gives as gifts. We say grace, we say mercy. That's how God gives. He doesn't pay you for what you do in the church. He doesn't pay you for your religious labors. Everything that he gives are gifts of his grace. You don't pay for your Christmas gifts, do you? Like someone hands you a Christmas gift and you say, oh, that is really nice. I've been wanting one of those. How much is that? How much did you pay? $50. All right, here you go. Well, you're just shopping if you're doing it that way. You're paying for something. You're earning it back. You're buying it back. But a gift is a gift. It's given and you don't pay for it. Thank goodness or we'd go broke at Christmas time. Paying back all those people for the things they get us. By the way, when is my Christmas present?
Today.
He's a little behind. You think I'm joking. He's given us our Christmas presents today. They're a little behind. So, gifts from the Lord. Gifts from the Lord. There are no spiritual purchases from the Lord. Only gifts. Doesn't matter how much you tithe. Those are not spiritual purchases. Those are gifts. Those are gifts to the Lord that you give and release freely, not to deserve or earn stuff back. Everything you get from the Lord is a gift. Verse 6. Then Jesus went with them. And when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy. I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof. So this is incredible. As Jesus is nearing the centurion's home here, The centurion gets word that, hey, Jesus is on his way to your home. He not only heard, he's not only going to do it, but he's coming to your house to do it. And the centurion is surprised by this because this was not the plan that he sent out. What? Jesus is coming to my home? No, please, please tell him not to bother. I'm not a worthy person. I'm not even a Jew. And he's the Jewish Messiah. This man knows who Jesus is. He's the Jewish Messiah. I'm not even a Jew. I'm a Gentile. I'm not worthy that he would come to my house. And besides, I didn't even get a chance to vacuum, you know. No. Don't have him come to my house. It's unnecessary. Verse 7, therefore, I did not even think myself worthy to come to you. I love this. I love this humility from this centurion. Not only does he find himself to be unworthy of Jesus coming to his home to do this, but he just said in verse 7, look, I didn't even feel like I was worthy enough to come out and ask you in person because I know who you are and I know why you've come and I know me quite well because of my unworthiness. That's why I sent out representatives. So there it is. Why did this guy send out representatives? Humility. Humility. He doesn't even feel worthy. It's stuff like this that we as a church need to keep in mind, because going back to that little scenario of how sometimes folks that don't attend church will turn to you, the church, in time of great need, and they'll ask you to pray, and they'll ask you to take those prayer needs before the church. And instead of thinking, well, I think if you were really all that interested in God's help, you would go yourself. Instead of thinking those kind of things, as we mentioned, perhaps here's something we should consider. The reason this man would not approach Jesus was his humility. And you know, the world out there, those folks that maybe don't come to church but ask you for prayer help, is it possible that sometimes the reason they don't ask, it's because they are well acquainted with the lifestyles that they live, and they're too embarrassed, and they're too humble to come to church? Now, if they knew the rest of you all that came here, they'd feel a lot more comfortable. No, I'm kidding. You can't talk to your church people like that. So that's something to keep in mind. Let's just do this. Whether people don't come out of feeling unworthy and undeserving, or whether they don't come out of desperation, but send that prayer with you out of desperation, like a last-ditch effort. Well, I don't go to church, but I know someone that does, and here's this last act of desperation. Regardless of what their motives might be, if they're asking the church to pray, I think we ought to open our hearts up to that. Because I know the Lord delivers and meets the needs for people that are unworthy and undeserving. But I also know that he meets the needs for people who turn to him in times of desperation. And it's not all about worth, is it? Gifts that the Lord gives. When people call on him, what really is the quantifier? It's always faith. It's always faith. Whether it's the churched people praying or the unchurched praying, the qualifier is always faith. Does a person have faith? And so this man says, but say the word, and my servant will be healed. This was the plan. This was all that the centurion was wanting from the get-go, is for Jesus to just speak the words. That's how much he believed in Jesus, that he knew if they could just get Jesus to speak the words of healing, that he could have full confidence that his servant would be healed. That's all he was going for. Jesus, just speak the words. His basis for believing that is in verse 8. You're going to see this guy really believes what he's saying. It's laid out for us in verse 8. But first off, before we get there, back up in verse 2. When this story is told by our narrator, Luke, and he uses the word servant here, it's the word doulos, which is the word for slave. Now, we say servant because servant sounds better. I'm serious about that. The King James Version translators started this. Doulos is the word for slave, but at the time there was some hesitancy and uneasiness with the topic of slavery there as they were translating the King James Version Bible, and so they decided to avoid the word slaves or slavery or anything like that, and so they went with the softer word, servants, but that's what the word is here. This man is a household slave, but when the centurion refers to him in verse 7, he does not use the word doulos, which is slave or servant. He uses the word pais, which is a word that can mean a little one, a servant, a child. It's a more intimate term, and it shows that this centurion really does care for this servant. He really loves this guy as if he was a family member. That was not a given in the culture, that servants, that household servants would be like accepted as one of the family. It wasn't a given, but this wasn't unprecedented either. A lot of times these folks would get very attached to their servants and they would become like family members to them. So much so that if they freed them, oftentimes those servants would stay. They'd say, "All right, thank you for my freedom, but I'm choosing to remain here as a willing slave." That's called a bond slave or a bond servant. That means I have my choice of freedom. I could leave and pursue my own life, but life here with my master is so good that I want to stay here. By the way, Paul in the New Testament refers to Christians as bond slaves, right? That is, we have our freedom. We can do what we want with it, but we understand our master's care, the Lord himself. We know him so well that we choose to remain his servants. That's how we use our freedom. It's a beautiful picture. But he loves this servant. Verse 8, he says, here's why I believe this. Here's why I believe that, Lord, if you'll just say these words, if you'll just speak healing over my servant, here's why I believe it'll happen. Verse 8, for I also, pay close attention to that word also, for I also am a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. Now, we read that quick, but this statement reveals three like massively important things about this centurion's faith in Jesus. First of all, he said this to Jesus, I also am a man under authority. I also, which means what? Lord, I understand you are a man under authority. Stick with me here for a minute. Just as this centurion was submitted to a higher power, just as this centurion did not generate his own orders or go on his own missions, but was always subject to those over him in the authority structure, in the same way he is recognizing Jesus to be that same way. He is recognizing that there is a higher authority that Jesus answers to. He recognizes that Jesus does not operate outside of that higher authority. Obviously, he knows we are dealing with God the Father here. I tell you, the stuff this servant knows about the Lord makes my head spin. Because here's the Jews struggling to see it, and this Gentile, he has Christ pegged. He has him figured out. Is this biblically correct? Is Jesus under authority? Did Jesus not come to do his will? Does Jesus not act independently of the Father? Here's two verses for you. 1 Corinthians 11:3, Paul said this, but I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ. So far, so good. The head of woman is man. We'll skip past that part. Listen to this last part. By the way, that's only if she'll let him be. Listen to this last part. And the head of Christ is God. The head of Christ is God. Here's another verse for you. John chapter 6, verse 38. Jesus said this, For I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. So he understands. Jesus is the Son of God. That's what he understands. He understands that Jesus is a representative of God the Father. Secondly, he says this, the centurion. He says, I can control those that have been placed under my authority. I can speak and I can move people. If they're under my authority, what I say goes. Now, my orders come from higher than me, but when I speak those orders, when I speak under that authority is extended out through me, and when I speak, people move to do what I say. He understands this principle, and from the context, he's saying that he understands this to be within the authority of Jesus too. And the context tells us what he understands that authority to be. Here's what he believes. He believes that Jesus, operating under the authority of the Father, has complete authority over all things pertaining to the human condition. Biology, nature, health, let's just say this, life. He understands that Jesus has authority over the lives of men and women. That is some pretty healthy faith from a Gentile centurion. Is that biblically correct? Look at Matthew chapter 28, verse 18. Jesus said, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Are you confused yet? I thought Jesus was submitted to authority. You just said, according to his own words, I have all authority on heaven and on earth. Yeah, listen. The will is God's. And when Jesus came to earth, Jesus knew the Father's will completely and entirely. We're still trying to figure it out sometimes. We're working on it. Lord, what did you mean by this? And what about that and the other? And we're trying to work our way through it. Jesus, when he came, he had complete knowledge of the will of the Father. And here's what the Father did. The Father gave Jesus all authority on heaven, in heaven and in earth to carry out his will. He is under authority, and yet he operates from a position of all authority. Did that clarify it, or did that make it even more complicated for you? So, here's the third important thing that this centurion believes about Jesus. If Jesus is the Son of God, then Jesus is in authority regardless of whether he is near or far. Jesus, I know enough about you to know that you don't have to show up to my house and lay your hands on my sick servant. Because if you are God near, you are God far. This is Jeremiah 23 kind of stuff. Jeremiah 23, verse 23, chapter 23, verse 23, where the Lord asked the question. He says, am I not a God near? And he says, and if I'm a God near, am I not God far off too? Pardon me, not a God, the God. I misquoted that. He asks it in the form of a question. He's saying, if I'm God near, then I'm God far as well. Even if I seem far away, even if you seem disconnected, you could still call on me and I'm still God. I'll still answer. I'll still meet the need. I'll still show up in the way that I need to show up. So he says, Jesus, you don't even have to be near my home to do this. You can just make the call and it'll be done. Well, I probably don't need to tell you that this centurion had Jesus figured out, had massive faith, and you would expect Jesus to like that, wouldn't you? And he does indeed. Look at verse 9. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him. Now, as you know, Anchored, it was tough to shock Jesus. It's tough to shock an all-knowing God. And yet, aren't there times where you know something's going to happen, but it happens and you're still shocked anyway because it's so big? Jesus could be shocked. He could marvel over things. We read it in the Gospels. And you'll see that Again, as you should know by now, there are two different things, two different people types that would cause Jesus to marvel throughout the Gospels. Number one would be people who had every reason in the world to have faith in him and yet didn't. That made him marvel. And the second would be people that really should have every reason not to have faith in him and yet did, as is the case with this Gentile man here. You can bear that out through the scriptures yourself. Go home and get your Bible concordance out, your Strong's concordance, whatever you might have, or go online. There's a bunch of free concordances online. And look up that word marveled. You'll have to sort through it. You'll have to sift through it because there's a lot of people in the Gospels that are marveling at Jesus, rightfully so. But you'll see those occasions where Jesus is marveling, and that's exactly what it is. He'll marvel at the Jews because of their history and heritage, because of their possession of the scriptures throughout all of the history of the Jewish nation. He'll look at the Jews and he'll marvel that they struggle with their faith in him. And he'll look at Gentiles who didn't have that same heritage, that same history, that same blessing and benefit of having been raised within the nation that God was working in. And he'll see those people who didn't have that advantage in life. He'll see them with great big faith that even the Jews didn't have. And it'll cause him to marvel. He's the same today. He never changes. You can make him marvel in two ways today. He might be marveling today over your lack of faith when you should have faith. He might be marveling today over your great faith when you have every reason not to believe. I want to be one that causes the Lord to marvel over my faith. That's where I want to be. A lot of people around me marvel at me all the time. And they'll say things like, oh, here goes Arlen again. And then they'll roll their eyes in their head. That's marveling. They're marveling at me. I choose to see that as a positive thing. No, they're not impressed by me, but I choose to think that way anyway. More power to those of us that can push past all of the reasons not to believe and choose to have a heart that still believes in spite of all of it. More power to the person that can just hear the words of Scripture. Things like ask and receive that your joy may be full, and you'll just go, okay, great, I love it. I'm in. I believe. I want to receive that. More power to you people, those people that have that kind of faith. Reading on, when Jesus heard these things, verse 9, he marveled at him and turned around and said to the crowd that followed him, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. This Gentile's faith in the Jewish Messiah had surpassed any faith that Jesus had seen in the Jews up until this point. Again, think of the disadvantage of the Gentiles spiritually. Gentiles did not have that history, that heritage, that spiritual training, that preparation for Messiah. They weren't studying those messianic prophecies like the Jews were for all those years. The Apostle Paul said in Romans 3 that the Jews have a great advantage over the Gentiles. Paul says this is the great advantage because to them has been committed the oracles of God. The Word of God has been given into the care of the Jews to preserve and to pass along. They've had those scriptures in the Old Testament to study. That is a great advantage. Growing up with God working actively in your nation. And yet here we see Gentiles poring over those messianic prophecies, understanding those messianic prophecies even while the Jews are struggling to get a make exactly on who Jesus is. Could he be the Messiah? If he is the Messiah, what are we looking for? Is he a suffering Messiah? Is he a victorious, reigning Messiah? And it just goes to show you that you do not have to be raised in church to come to a place of great faith in the Lord. I know how privileged many of us were to be raised as we were in a church, seeing God move, seeing things, watching God save and heal people. But just because many of us were raised in church, that did not mean that faith came easy, did it? It's not how it worked for me. We had to fight off some things being raised with that rich history and heritage. We had to fight off familiarity and comfortability, apathy. We had to persevere through some things. We had to fight off misunderstandings of the scriptures that were spoken from behind pulpits. We had to persevere through stuff in order to keep our faith in Jesus white hot. So we didn't have it easy. And we still don't. Sometimes the worst thing you can do for your faith is hang around a jaded religious person. They've spent years tightening the noose around their powerless versions of theology because God didn't do for them. They couldn't come up with the faith, and they're happy to drag you down with them to a place of faithlessness and powerlessness. Having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. From such turn away. They will do their best to talk you out of mountain moving kind of faith. They will try to normalize the misery of unbelief and limitations on God, because misery loves company. So, hey, we church folks have been through stuff too. We had to find our faith in Jesus, and it had to go deeper than people. And if you're here today and you haven't had that church upbringing, I'm telling you, the scriptures point very clearly to this fact, that the Lord can show up in your life at any point in your life. And he can make you a person of great faith, maybe such great faith that the rest of the church folk around you will kind of just sit and look at you as if you're an enigma. Where did that kind of faith come from? What church did they grow up in? Must have been Pentecostal. No, the Lord can bring great faith out of any willing heart. Verse 10, and those who were sent, returning to the house, found the servant well who had been sick. Now, Luke didn't tell us what Jesus spoke here after he made this statement about this man's great faith. But Matthew tells us in Matthew's record, Matthew chapter 8, verse 13, it says this, then Jesus said to the centurion, go your way, and as you have believed, so let it be done for you. And his servant was healed that same hour. So Jesus was saying, we're going to do this your way because of your faith. I was coming to your house. That was my plan. I was going to come to your house and I was going to heal him personally. But your faith is so big that you believing for a miracle that takes place from afar off, that's a really good thing for people to see and for you to experience. If your faith is that big, let it be so according to your faith. You know, you wouldn't want to disappoint the guy, would you? Like, he had faith that Jesus didn't even have to be there. I'd really wonder if Jesus said, no, I need to be there. No, he wasn't going to disappoint this man's faith. He was not going to fly under that bar of expectation and faith that the centurion had. he was going to go right along with that level of faith that he did have and do it exactly according to what the man believed for. So he speaks the word a little distance from the home, and the servant is healed in the same hour, the scripture tells us. And now Jesus is going to head off to a place called Nain, and he's going to keep another divine appointment. That's what these things are. They're Jesus showing up exactly where he needs to be in order to meet the exact needs that he needs to meet. And next week, a very interesting study, verses 11 through 17, you're going to see Jesus in the crowd heading into the city gate of Nain. And at the same time, right when Jesus and the multitude gets there, there's a little bit of a traffic jam because at the same time, there is a funeral procession heading outside of the city gate. You have one group rejoicing in the things that the Lord has done. You have another group coming out that are sorrowing and mourning over the harsh realities of life. And the two groups are going to collide. And we're going to see Jesus do something even bigger than healing a man on his deathbed.